Leading Ideas Talks is brought to you by the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. Subscribe free to our weekly newsletter at www.churchleadership.com/leading ideas. How can churches grow beyond simply engaging in political activism and instead practice sacred resistance? Lewis Center Associate Director Ann A. Michael speaks with Ginger Gaines Sorelli, pastor of Foundry United Methodist Church in downtown Washington, D.C., about sacred resistance as a way of being grounded in the gospel and who we are as people of faith.
I'm Ann Michael, Associate Director of the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary, and I'm also editor of Leading Ideas e-newsletter, and I am here on location at the historic Foundry United Methodist Church in downtown D.C., talking with Pastor Ginger Gaines Sorelli about her new book, Sacred Resistance, A Practical Guide to Christian Witness and Dissent. So we're so glad to be with you today, Ginger.
It's a delight to have you.
Yeah. So I think it would be helpful to our listeners to first get a little bit of a sense of your context here at Foundry, sort of the history of the church and your role here as a leader at Foundry.
Foundry has over 200-year history here serving Washington, D.C., and I had the privilege of being appointed to serve as the pastor here in 2014, in the bicentennial year of the congregation, their first woman senior pastor, and that is my role, is to serve as the senior pastor of the congregation. Foundry has a long-standing history of engagement in the public square, in the Ministry of Social Justice, as well as a vibrant and vital communal life and worshiping life and music tradition. It's a pretty phenomenal community to have the privilege to serve.
Is that what inspired you to take on the subject of sacred resistance?
Well, I have to say, you know, I was engaging with the congregation from pretty much the moment I arrived in the work of sacred resistance, but the phrase didn't really begin to emerge in my heart and mind until the midst of the 2016 presidential elections. It was something, I don't even know where it came from, but began to use it. I began to use it in my social media. It was a hashtag I started to use when I would be responding or pondering or thinking about the varieties of issues and challenges that people were wrestling with and struggling with in their lives and in the world. And to begin to try to think about those things from the perspective of faith, of our Christian faith, and what it meant to try to stand and to resist those things that were not of God, in a way that felt grounded in love and hope.
So the actual term sacred resistance just emerged organically.
Yeah, I talking with a couple of different folks, I may have seen it somewhere along the line. I think the first public, one of my editors did some research on this and said that the first instance that he ever saw anywhere that he could find of the phrase was in the midst of the Native American protests around water. And that was one of the places that it started to show up. My guess is I saw it at some point and picked up on that and then began to really allow it to evolve and emerge in my own thinking.
As you've come to own that term, mm-hmm. How do you define it?
Well, what was interesting was when I sat down to actually try to write about the topic, I realized that it's not something that I can define necessarily in a word or a phrase. If I had to try to do that, I think I would say that sacred resistance is a stance. It's a way of being, not just something that you do. And it's about standing for God's way in the face of all that is not God's way. And sacred resistance is that. It's to be grounded in the ways of God and to recognize what is not of God and to say yes to God, which is, of course, a no to that which isn't. There are lots of different contours and commitments that, as I thought more about it, really flesh out that vision. But it's really about trying to to follow Jesus. I mean, that's so the pretty the bottom line.
It's bigger than political
Absolutely.
Activism.
Yes, yeah. yes. At least the way that I've conceived it. I'm aware that some folk may accuse the way that I'm using it, accuse me of just trying to kind of play with words and make it something that it's not. But my deep conviction is that it is more than just political activism. It is that, in a sense. There is activism. It is political. But it's deeply grounded and driven by who we are as people of faith, as people who are grounded in and hopefully formed by gospel, by the prophetic tradition, by the ways that the love, mercy, and justice of God were revealed in Jesus Christ. So those are the things that give us the shape and the energy of the way that we're going to be in the public square seeking to resist that which is not God's way.
Mm-hmm. Early in the book, you take on the idea that church and politics don't mix. Mm. do you want to address that just briefly?
It's, you know, it's one of the things that I imagine most clergy have heard, and some will probably espouse, that politics and church don't mix. I think that that is incorrect. I think that, politics, the word comes from the word polis, the Greek word polis, which, you know, is the city, it's community, it's people living together. And from the beginning, the prophetic tradition, Jesus, who was the fulfillment of the prophetic tradition, were all about how we live together in community. So if the church is saying that we can't in some way intentionally be engaged in what is happening in the polis, in the political life of the larger community, then I think we are missing a huge, if not most, of the biblical text, the tradition, and who it is that we're called to be. I mean, Jesus came to transform the whole world, to help heal the world that was broken and that needed mending. And if we stay in our private enclaves wanting to have warm spiritual feelings and not be willing to engage the really, really difficult questions, then I think we're missing much of the call.
Yeah, I think sometimes where the church gets mixed up in terms of politics in church is more when it's partisanship mm-hmm. in church. I know, at least in progressive congregations, in the church I attend, we've really had to make space for people who don't aren't as progressive as mm-hmm. is typical in this part of the country or typical of the people that are sitting in our pews. And so the pushback isn't necessarily coming in the way that you might expect it. Yeah. It's coming from people who feel excluded because their perspective isn't always the dominant voice that's heard in church.
Mm-hmm. I think it's one of the biggest challenges everywhere, but certainly in places like where we live here in Washington, D.C., which is tends to be much further towards the what people call the left, and I hate those boxes that we put one another in. But it is one of the greatest challenges. I think one of the extraordinary opportunities for people of faith and for the church, which I don't know that many have anywhere have fully received or tried to live out, is this invitation to make our citizenship primarily the kingdom of God, as opposed to whatever place, you know, whatever the state we live in, the country we live in, but to say our primary citizenship is God's reign, is the kingdom. And if we do that, then it doesn't make things easier. It doesn't make the challenges go away, the tensions go away, the partisanship magically disappear, but what it gives us is this sense of a grounding and a longer history. It forces us, if we're willing to really do it, to try to live together in a different way, and to then witness to the larger community, which is a huge piece of it, that there is an alternative to the partisanship. There's an alternative to us versus them. There's an alternative to, you know, this hard line. I can't even be in conversation with you because you're not going to agree with me. Which is so much of what happens. It's like we just figure, what's the point of having a conversation if I can't get you to think the way I think? which if we think that's the point, then again, I think we're really missing a huge opportunity for growth and wisdom and for a really vital experience of Christian community.
I wanted to ask you what moved you to take on the subject. I would imagine that that's part of it, but is there more?
I mean, I think a big piece of it was just my own increased awakening. Being part of Foundry Church, it's just sort of built in that you're going to be engaging critical questions and what's happening in the larger society and world. But I think there was this growing sense of even in this place, had been a little, had gotten a little bit lazy, maybe, in remembering what it really means to be Christian community and the ways that how we are together are, that's the space in which we learn how to engage the work of sacred resistance in moments when it gets really, really hard. And so the challenges and all of that pain and struggle that people were feeling on every, you know, at every point of every conversation during that crazy presidential election year, I think it just brought to me this clarity that we need to ground ourselves in the tradition. We need to understand that this is more than just political partisanship, that the church is called to offer something different, to go deep so that we can be responsive and not just reactive, so that we can create space. We can begin to be the church that makes space for folks that are coming from different perspectives. It was a clarifying moment for me, and I think I recognized that even as active and, you know, engaged as I might have been, I felt like some really key things were missing. So this was a call, quite frankly, because I had other things to do. I did not need to be trying to flesh this out and figure all this out, but it really began to feel like a calling to try to put some shape to this energy that I was feeling and that I sensed other people were feeling and wanting to have some language for.
Yeah, that's actually a really good segue into what I wanted to ask you about next, and that is when I read the book, I saw the subtitle, A Practical Guide to Christian Witness and Dissent, and sort of thought it was going to be a how-to manual for congregations that wanted to get more active in advocacy or public issues or whatever. And not surprisingly, since I know you, the book is really preponderantly about theology.
Yeah.
And so just for the benefit of our listeners, I know this isn't necessarily a subject that lends itself to brevity. It's really the bulk of the book. But can you just name what you think are some of the most significant aspects of the theological tradition that relate to this question?
Mm-hmm. I will do that. And before I do that, I want to say that for me, and I think one of the things that sometimes folk may forget, is that if our theology is not practical, then what's the point? Theology, when we do it well and robustly and in a way that is connected to real life, which is really what it's supposed to be, anytime we talk about God, it's got to be connected to our lives because God is intimately engaged with our lives. So I see theology as deeply, deeply practical if we're doing it well. And with that being said, I would say that certain pieces of the theological tradition that have been particularly helpful in this work are the prophetic tradition. I have been reading and rereading Walter Brueggemann and his work in the Old Testament prophets for the last couple of years, and that's been really important. I would also say the ethical tradition of the Judeo-Christian faith, you know, the way that we love neighbor. How do we love neighbor? So loving God and that vision of God that the prophets are always calling us back to against idolatry and back to the love of God. Who do you love? Who do you serve? It's that prophetic piece. The love of neighbor is the ethical tradition. And then, of course, both of those were fully embodied and taught by Jesus. And so it's really about being a Jesus follower. So the theology of Jesus, what Jesus taught about the ways that we are called to serve God and to love neighbor, and then to truly try to embody that with some integrity, humility, hopefulness, gentleness, courage, a willingness to do the right thing when it's the hardest thing, even when it's the hardest thing. I mean, those are the things that really, I think, ground the sort of key contours of the theological tradition that have given shape to this work for me.
Mm-hmm. So, turning the corner a little bit into the more practical realm, what do you think are some of the mistakes that churches tend to make when they venture into the public square?
Well, I think it's very easy when there's a crisis for churches to get very engaged and active. And sometimes that doesn't, it's we don't get organized enough, or we aren't committed enough, or whatever. We get too busy, distracted, to actually stay engaged. So I think one of the challenges is to figure out where a particular church wants to, or is called to, or has the resources to be engaged in the public square, and then to really develop how they're going to do that over time. What is the goal? What are the resources that they can bring to bear to make a real impact? So I think that's one piece. Pastor Ben here at Foundry talks about policy by Twitter, which I think is hilarious, and I think it's true, is that, you know, people can feel like they get all worked up, and they go and they do their tweet storm, and they think, ooh, I've done my work of social justice, when in fact it's probably going to make no difference at all. And we can feel good that we've, like, been involved.
Yeah.
We sounded off. We said our thing. But what difference has it made? So I think that's a piece of it. I think other things that might be pitfalls for congregations are what we were talking a little bit about before, which is tending to fall into echo chambers, to really align with a certain political party, or to say we're left or we're right, and to lose that sense of wholeness that we're really called to, and the ways that the church is called to be mending those broken places, not feeding them. And that's not to say, I want to be very clear, that's not to say that the church can't take stances on things. We have to. We have to step out. We have to be strong. We have to advocate for the things that we think we're, are gospel, are what we're called to. But keeping perspective, I think we lose perspective. And to try to keep the sense of the common good and the wholeness to which we're called to be working, for which we're called to be working, I think those are pitfalls. So reactivity, judgmentalism, atrophy.
Yeah, I appreciated the part of the book where you outlined how to decide where to engage, mm-hmm. because I think incumbent in what you just said is a need to prioritize.
Yes.
That you can't do everything.
No.
And if you try to, you're just going to be totally scattershot. And so a deliberate process by which you decide how you're going to pick your battles.
Yeah. It's really important. And I mean, it seems, I have this tendency to think that some of those things are just obvious, but I think sometimes we forget and we just need to say it. It's like, no, we can't do everything. You have to figure out what the resources are that you have in your place, in your congregation. Where's the passion? Where are the resources? And where do those align with, you know, one or two critical needs in your community where you want to engage?
Yeah. I think the protest reflex is so strong right now, mm-hmm. Whether it's been the Black Lives Matter movement or the more recent issues around guns and women's rights and so forth. I see congregations so quick to mobilize for that kind of action that can be incredibly impactful and meaningful. And yet, if it doesn't, then evolve into ongoing real engagement, I think it's almost like the Twitter.
Yeah. Well, and it's not just that. It's not that, you know, we put a lot of energy for these short bursts that doesn't really make it, potentially doesn't really make much of an impact. So it's not just that, but it's also that it can also be very sort of disillusion. It can provide the sense of disillusionment for the congregation. Like, well, we had all this energy around this thing, but then now nothing's happening, or we really haven't made a difference, or, you know, so it can take the wind out of a congregation's sails if, you know, everyone's all up and, you know, ready to go, but then no one goes anywhere.
So I began with the question of the mistakes that churches make, but I wanted to kind of flip that around and ask the question of what difference do you think it makes when a church really is beginning with this theological clarity around a posture of sacred resistance, and they're really coming at this work well grounded in the traditions of the faith.
Well, I think that that kind of grounding and formation allows a person or a community of faith to persevere, quite honestly. In all of our work, both in the faith traditions and outside the traditions, we can get so burned out with this work. And I think that being part of a movement that we know has been ongoing for centuries and centuries, that we're part of this larger story that is really the work of God, which is the critical piece. This is God's work of mending, and our time in creation is to participate in that. And this is our stretch of the journey. And so it allows us to hold that, our struggle, in the perspective of that larger work of God. And I think that's huge. It also, connected to that, is that sense that this is not up to us. I think that apart from that deep grounding in faith and the formation of being part of a community that's really shaped by the crucified one, the rejected one, is that that we know who we are. We have a sense of who we are trying to be, and we know who it is we're called to stand with, and that's those who are the crucified and rejected ones. And so it gives us a clear sense of direction and purpose for the journey. And I think the other piece is that communities that are really grounded in the tradition and in a deep faith and connection to Christ is a sense of hope, so that there is, again, it's not all up to us. We know it's part of this larger work of God. We know that what we're doing, even when we can't see it, if we are serving those who are rejected and persecuted and oppressed, that we are participating in something that is going to come to something else. So there's a sense of promise. And that, again, is huge. So, and it's not that folk outside a faith community might not have some of those things, you know, but these are particular resources of our faith that we've got a story, we've got a future, you know, and we know that we're part of this larger thing. So, yeah, I think that's
part. I wanted to get your perspective and your expertise really on some questions that I have struggled with a lot in my own leadership in the church. And my own teaching and thinking. As somebody who's done a lot of work in Christian advocacy and in mission leadership, one of the things that concerns me a lot is that when we go out, when we go to City Hall, when we go to the protest march, when we go to the mission field, when we are on the Habitat build, all these things that we are taking on in the name of our faith, that we don't do that work in much different way than any other do-gooder cause would do. Mm-hmm. We don't look any different than the Kiwanis Club group or the League of Women Voters, or as I've done a lot of work recently with young clergy in the United Church of Christ, and their joke is we're the Democratic Party at prayer. But the reason that joke is so poignant is because they're really struggling with what does it mean to be a church that is doing this kind of work as opposed to any other nonprofit or advocacy group that's doing this work. And so I think what I've really been struggling with is how do we make sure that when we're doing this work alongside other allies who mm-hmm. probably are doing similar work, that it becomes a genuine act of Christian witness and not just one more organization in the mix.
Well, I want to say that I think there's a lot of what I would call Christian work happening that's not happening under the banner of being Christian work. And so so I just want to say that first, which is to say a lot of these organizations with which we come alongside and partner are doing amazing, amazing, what I would call ministry of mending, of healing, of caring in the world. And so there, it seems right to me that churches would be discerning about who they're going to partner with and then figure out how to do that in a way that is has integrity based on who we are as people of faith. I'm not sure we always have to do it differently, but it's about, are we doing it? There's some of us, you know, who are kind of used to being in more engaged congregations and circles that are doing some of this work, I think, that forget how many churches don't do it at all. And I want to really encourage folk to keep that in perspective as well. So all of that being said, so I think we need to partner with people. I think that mission partnerships are important. I think that the church doesn't have to do it all on its own. But the question I hear you asking is, how do we do that even with this deeper sense of groundedness in our faith? And again, I kind of tend to come back to how are we preparing people and how are we sending people out to do that work? So it seems to me the work of the church is to help folk understand why they're going to go and do that and then how they're going to try to be present in that space. And again, it doesn't have to be about one. So a clear sense of being sent, you know, what's the gospel story around that? Why are we sent? Why do we need to be engaging in this work? What does it have to do with the larger work that of God's mending the world? Like, you know, what are the gifts that I bring and what is it that God may be doing through me? And how can I, as somebody who's going forth to do work as part of my church or synagogue or whatever with this organization, how am I going to be in discernment through this work about what Spirit is doing in me? What are the lessons that God's trying to give me through this work? So I think it's about that kind of loop of grounding and teaching so that one has a sense of what it is that we as disciples are called to do and be, a sense of how to discern, a sense of call. So this is where I want to go to serve. And then how am I going to continue to grow and deepen my discipleship through that work? That, I think, is the work of the church. That's what we particularly are able to do, is to help people be sensitive and aware to movements of spirit and the way that God is working in and through us so that we can continue to allow ourselves to be loved and used by God, because that's what's going to have the most powerful transformation. And if we are those people who know ourselves, who are loved and used by God, who are showing up in a nonprofit to do something, then it's up to Spirit to do with us what needs to be done. Do you see what I mean?
Yes, I do see what you mean.
Yeah.
And I my ears perked up when you used the word loop, mm-hmm. because the other thing, the other aspect of this that I've really struggled with is I think the classic way that we think about spiritual formation in the church is that we come to church, we read our Bibles, we hear the sermons, we worship, we're formed. Mm-hmm. And then we go and take that formation out into the world and act. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that that's always the way it happens anymore. Yeah. I think people are formed in faith by acting in mm-hmm. faith. We know that a lot of younger people, the leading edge of what we are offering them, what's attractive to them, is what we do in the world. Yeah. And so they're often connected to that before they're fully formed in the faith. Mm-hmm. And I've become very intrigued in thinking about how it is that we form people in faith through social justice, mm-hmm. through mission engagement, that those become the formative acts, the teaching opportunities, the teachable moments that point people to gospel.
Yep.
Instead of assuming that they understand gospel before they go to do those things.
Yep, yep. That it makes me think, as you were saying that, it brought me back to, you know, my first semester in divinity school and Luddy Russell teaching us the liberation theology spiral, which is you come at it, you know, at different points on the journey, and some are going to enter from the action point, some are going to enter from the study points and we're going to enter from the worship and ritual point. But wherever it is, you know, it's this movement. And it's really, really critical. But I think that the role of the church is to provide the resources, however those are developed, to help people know and love God.
Yeah.
Because that's what changes the world.
Absolutely. I think what I find frustrating, though, is that we don't... I don't think we equip people very well for that leadership task. We teach people how to teach Bible in a classroom. We teach people how to preach from a pulpit. We teach our lay leaders how to go out and get the work done. I don't know that we have thought a lot about how we do that work of formation on the run.
Yeah, that's a good phrase. And it is something that I think is probably going to be one of the most important pieces for us to continue to develop as we think about. I mean, I think about all of these different places, anywhere we find ourselves with as citizens of the kingdom, then we are in the process of we should be learning something. You know, we should be thinking about, okay, well, what? How does this serve or not serve? What is going? You know, what is it that? That God is doing in me, for me, through me right now. Like, how can I deepen my own witness, my own faith, my own love, you know, wherever we are. And so developing ways to help people do that.
Yeah, the naming and framing, yeah. I think, is something that leaders can bring, mm-hmm. help bring the faith perspective, you know, when people are in the midst of this. Yeah. And people start to think that it's a task to be done rather than a pilgrimage.
Yeah, yeah. The part of the larger story, part of the larger drama, part of the larger work. And the right questions are key. I mean, what if we just sent everybody out with the right set of questions?
Yep.
You know, like every so often pause and think about these things.
Yeah. Yeah. No, this is something I give a lot of thought to, and I emphasize a lot in my leadership teaching. I just often find, though, at least in my own church, the kind of people who are drawn to the more active work, mm-hmm. They're often the doers. and they're not as inclined to be thinking the deep thoughts about it.
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah. And I understand all that. And as you all have noticed, I mean, I'm determined to try to help people, like recognize how important, at least here and there, really being clear about what the grounding is. Otherwise, you know, folk who come at the more active churches and folk with all of those accusations that you're just the Democratic Party at prayer or Democrat, you know, then they could be right. You know what I mean? I mean, it can be, we can have very, very thin reasons and really lose perspective and really lose our grounding if we don't take some time and make a really intentional effort. To be connected to what's most real.
Yeah. So to try to draw this conversation around sacred resistance to a conclusion, I wanted to end with a question about the hope or the vision that you see coming out of this sense of sacred resistance, because it seems like the concept of sacred resistance is oppositional almost, but oppositional to an end. And so what's the hope or the vision that you see this pointing to?
Well, one of the things that I really try to offer in the book is a vision of sacred resistance, which is not just defensive or oppositional, but really deeply creative. So that if we are, I mean, as I read the prophetic tradition, for example, to say no to something is to say yes to the greater thing. And so if we are resisting that which is not of God in ourselves, in the world, in our own congregations, the way that we, you know, can not really live out our shared lives sometimes with integrity or in the ways that we know we're called to, wherever those things take shape, then we are participating in the creative work of God. We're creating something new. And my hope, my deep hope, is that people will be encouraged to be connected to the tradition, whether that's in community or just on their own, like whatever it is that is going to help people know and love God more in a way that's going to help fuel them and ground them in the love of God, which is where sacred resistance starts. It's one of my core beliefs, which is that sacred resistance at its core is the love of God. God's love for us is the first sacred resistance. God doesn't abandon us. God doesn't stop loving us when we stop loving God. And that is that's the vision. So if folk can get that and be encouraged and inspired and willing to step up and speak up, which is another thing we didn't really talk much about, but we got to say stuff. but did we be willing to like put ourselves out there and to trust the love of God? I think that would be an encouraging thing.
Yeah. I mean, I find anyways that faith really does give you a vocabulary and a worldview that allows you to see the resurrection hope in things that other people find difficult and discouraging. And I think of what a tremendous gift that is. And it's not all rosy. Mm-mm, I mean, a lot of it is the nature of sacrifice and the reality of the cruciform shape of transformation.
Yeah.
But that's an amazing gift to be able to approach the world with that knowledge of how God works in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, it's profoundly transformative.
Yeah. I'm determined to keep trying to, in my own life and in the community in which I serve, the communities in which I move, to say in a culture of sound bites and spin, that there is a deep, nourishing word and story that that we get to simply step into and be part of, and we are part of. And in order for us to really reap the full benefit of that and get to fully participate in it and accomplish all that we might accomplish, we need to be willing to give ourselves we need to spend some time. We need to go deep. We need to do some work. We need to sacrifice some things. And it's not I don't think a terribly popular position, because it's not snappy and it's not easy. I think about that G.K. Chesterton quote that says, let me see if I can pull it up. Christianity has not been tried and found wanting. Christianity has been found difficult and left untried. I think sacred resistance is what we're called to, and it means being a community of the cross, and the cross isn't easy. But the cross is what brings life into this world in a new way. And so that's our work.
Yep. Well, you've done a tremendous service, I think, to the church in sharing your way of thinking about this. And I know that this book is going to be a tremendous resource to a lot of people. So thank you for the book. Thank you for the work that went behind it. But thank you for talking with us today as well. We try to end our podcast interviews by asking our interviewees two questions. The first is, what are you reading right now?
I am reading right now a collection of poetry called Joy, edited by Christian Wyman. And I'm also reading Anatomy of Peace, which is a book that a lot of folk are reading right now in the United Methodist Church as we seek to find our way through to a place of peace in our community and communion.
And what leader has personally inspired you the most?
That really is a very difficult question. Yeah. I have a lot of people that come to mind. And hilariously, the first person that popped into my head, I had two people come to mind, and they're both people I don't know, but who are poets. It's sort of a theme with me. Wendell Berry, I think, is one of the leaders who inspires me for his groundedness in place and his commitment to social justice and the way that he lives that out in his own context and uses the gifts that he has to really impact and inspire people. And another poet that I would say deeply inspires and has affected me is Mary Oliver. One of my teachers, I have to also add Serene Jones, who's the president now at Union Theological Seminary, has been a really important mentor for me, an encourager, somebody who has seen my gifts and encouraged them, and also been a model for me of what it looks like to be real, to be authentic, to be a woman in leadership and in the church.
Thank you, Ginger. Thank you for talking with us today. Thank you for your sacred resistance and for what it brings to our city here of Washington, D.C. It's a joy to know of the work of Foundry. You're my neighbor here in DuPont Circle, so I'm well aware of Foundry's tremendous tradition and the great work that you're doing, and thank you so very much.
Thank you, Anne.
Leading Ideas Talks has been brought to you by the Taking Church to the Community Video Toolkit. Explore strategies your congregation can use to reach beyond its walls with worship, community events, ministries, and service to reach community members where they are. Taking Church to the Community is available on download and DVD at churchleadership.com/community. On our next episode of Leading Ideas Talks, Lewis Center Director Doug Poe speaks with Reverend Olu Brown of Impact Church in Atlanta about how churches can reach new people through extreme hospitality and by dreaming big.
Looking at this word called relevant, this can be a very controversial word in the church. So some people think if we're relevant with the current culture, we can't be authentic to our values. But if you look at for-profit organizations and you take an audio company, for instance, that makes a particular type of audio player, that audio player may have originally come onto the market in 1975. And now in 2018, it is one of the best sellers. The original purpose of that audio player is to provide music audibly to the listener. Now, if you look at the packaging and the transformation of packaging from it first coming into the marketplace to now 2018, it's probably changed 10 or 15 times. It's the exact opposite with the local church. We want to keep our consistent messaging, which is fine, but we are afraid of packaging and retooling that so that current and younger generations will hear it and receive it.
Leading Ideas Talks is available on iTunes, the Google Play Store, and Stitcher. Subscribe today. Thank you for joining us, and don't forget to subscribe free to Leading Ideas at churchleadership.com/leadingideas.